It's 4:58 a.m. at a non-denominational church service in the Coachella Valley. And you're listening to Night Call. Night Call.
Hello, and welcome to Night Call, a podcast for your strange days and lonely nights. My name is Emily Yoshida. I am in New York, and with me on the other line, as always, we have...
Molly Lambert, and across from me...
Hello, I'm Tess Lynch!
And Hello. Of course, I'm Tess Lynch!
And of course, I never stop doing it, and I won't.
I did the intro for today's episode somewhat blindly, because I know that there is a new hot religion that has taken seed in California, but I don't know all the details of it, other than it involves Kanye West and that it is headed for Coachella,
well,
as all cultural phenomena are eventually. But please tell me everything, Molly.
Sunday services expert Molly Lambert, logging on.
Login accepted.
What I learned from tweeting about this is that Kanye fans get really mad if you call it a church. Apparently they're like, it's not a church. Nobody called it a church. It's just a gathering.
A religious gathering.
Well, but it is not a church service. There's no pastor. It's just people gathering in an outdoor space in Calabasas somewhere to listen to a gospel choir and Kanye play Kanye songs and like classic R&B songs.
Okay. So is Kris Jenner the kind of like puppet master?
Here's what I learned about this, because I was like, oh, like I saw these blind items. Emily also saw them about Kris Jenner starting a religion. Then I looked into it. Turns out Kris Jenner did start a church. It's different than this.
No.
She started a church in, I believe, 2014. Mm-hmm. It was 2014 or 2016. That is called... I should have looked it up, but it's called something very banal and Christian.
Yeah.
It's like the Christian Fellowship Association or mm-hmm. something. And it is not yet confirmed that the Kanye Sunday services have anything to do with Kris Jenner's own.
But how could they not?
I feel like there's a lot of ways that they could not. Like the blind item that I read actually had nothing to do with Kris Jenner. It was hinting that Kanye was starting a church that was going to be like ostensibly, you know, non-denominational, just sort of like a gathering. But the end result was that it was they would literally be worshiping him.
That's
like it would be a church to
worship
it Kanye.
Seems like
I want to read that blind item.
Have you seen the
very badly?
If you watch the videos, because okay, so they've been like promoting this. It's clearly like all of a sudden we're hearing about it because their information being seeded by Kris Jenner. For us to find out, but they've been posting videos of like, here's Northwest like dancing at church, but they or not at church, but just like dancing at Sunday services or whatever. And they didn't say specifically where it was. And then they were like, hey, it's this thing, Sunday services. We all just hang out in this rented outdoor space somewhere. And we invited all these celebrities, such as Orlando Bloom and Katy Perry, I believe, attended. And
you would think that Katy Perry would stay the hell away from given her background.
I know. And you'd think a lot of these people would still be staying away from Kanye, given all the Trump stuff recently.
Yeah.
If this were like 10 years ago and this were like the direction he went in, people would be like, oh, interesting, a gospel album.
Right.
Sure. But because it's now.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's going to go in a good direction.
It's hard for me to look at these things even at this point because I feel like I do not want to. Like, I feel like it's out of respect for Kanye. I need to look away, which is something we've kind of talked about
on our podcast before.
It has this weird sense of, like, as, like, an influencer church, even if it's a small one for right now, I cannot help but think of, like, this is such a nerdy comparison, but it's, like, Disney no longer taking movies to Comic-Con. Like, if Hillsong is Comic-Con, it's, like, we'll do our own thing. We'll have all the best properties and people at this thing.
It definitely seems like inspired directly by proximity to Hillsong, you know, which also is, has a big West Valley presence.
Everybody went there.
Yeah, all these people have gone to Hillsong, which, you know, is a cult and is a Christian cult that has a lot of the music festival Christianity, the sort of like more recent rebranding of Christianity is like Jesus liked to wander in the desert in sandals. That's what we're all doing at Coachella.
Oh, come on. I don't wear sandals to cook.
You don't? It's so hot,
it's a
though.
Fool's errand.
It's so hot. Then again, I wore sandals to Coachella and stepped on a chopstick and got...
Right, but Jesus wouldn't complain.
That's why.
Yeah. Jesus wouldn't complain. It's true. Stigmata.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You got stigmata at Coachella. Well,
how Christ-like of you.
I was extremely Christ-like the whole time at Coachella, and don't let anyone tell you I wasn't.
So this is eventually, he's taking the service to like an outpost or something, or they're doing a pop-up at Coachella.
They're doing
apparently.
A pop-up at Coachella, but it seems to me like they're recruiting people actively.
Right.
And whether the goal is to recruit people into an actual organization or just to sell them merch, like
right.
I guess what's the difference a little bit?
Yeah.
But they're definitely going to sell some merch.
Oh, for sure.
By all reports... Kanye is rather hurting financially. Mm. That's the last I heard when I read anything in depth or even just gossipy about him, was that like all was not well.
I mean, I will say also that like when you see the footage of this, because like a lot of Kanye fans, again, are in my mentions being like, why are you being so cynical? It's just people celebrating, you know, God and music. Like, don't be a hater. But it's a little sinister looking just because it's like everybody's wearing these white outfits. It's a little culty looking.
It looks culty,
like,
definitely.
Polyphonic Spree was like not that long ago, but I guess everybody's too young to remember that now.
Wait, what happened with the Polyphonic Spree?
Just cult themed stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
The optics.
It doesn't seem
know.
Like the time for Kanye to go in the cult themed.
No.
Yeah.
He has to wait a little while. I mean, I think that he could have done it right after, like, Ultralight Beams, like, that performance on SNL. Mm-hmm. I feel like the world was ready for, like, Kanye to pivot to being a pastor.
No, pivot to Jesus makes sense, but he has that. I mean, other people were like,
but
he
that
does.
Was before all this other shit happened.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Yeah.
But people were like, he has a lot of the qualities of, like, a mega pastor anyway. Yeah.
Does he, though? He seems very unsure of himself at times, which seems to be not what a, like, cult leader needs to have. I mean,
well, I was reminded of, because the Pitchfork, you know, they sometimes run reviews of older albums that they didn't have reviewed. And so they had done a review of the second Fiona Apple album, When the Pawn, which is, like, one of my favorite albums of all time. But I've forgotten that was also one of Kanye's favorite albums of all time. And he said he listened to Fiona Apple because he wanted to be able to rap as if he was rapping from the top of a mountain, I believe was the quote.
Whoa.
So, like, this triangle between, like being a, like, an evangelical or, like you know, that televangelist quality, Fiona Apple and Kanye West is, like, an odd one. But I like trying to put it together in
You were saying something good on Twitter the other day where you were like, Jesus never had a midlife crisis. Like, that's the whole appeal.
Oh, right. Well, that's because of this Mary Magdalene movie that's coming out with Rooney.
Right. You
Mara,
were like, Joaquin Phoenix is too old to play Jesus.
Yeah. Yes. He's like in his mid-40s and he's basically giving the same performance that he gave in You Were Never Really Here as like a PTSD suffering like hitman who like that's how the Jesus is presented.
That's too bad. I was hoping for like Sportella Jesus.
Well, it's sort of there. It's a very slurry Jesus. It's an interesting performance. But Jesus is hot now. Jesus is cool. And that movie also has a lot of like white gauze and stuff. It's a similar.
Isn't that
look.
Like what all the cool churches are just like? Jesus was hot. Jesus was
right.
Cool. Hey, Nightcall listeners. Have you heard about this company making stylish shoes for women and girls out of recycled plastic water bottles? Oh, and they're insanely comfortable and machine washable. Rothy's has quickly grown to a most loved, gotta have them brand. It's no surprise they have over 1,000 nearly perfect reviews. They're stylish, sustainable, comfortable, washable. They're the perfect flats for life on the go. I got my Rothy's a few months ago, and I have worn them a bunch of times to formal occasions. I like to wear flats, and so these are perfect flats. They're really comfortable. They have a really good sole. And as you're saying, you can wash them because they are made out of recyclable plastic, which is awesome because I like to wear shoes out a lot. Rothy's are the everyday flats for life on the go. They're stylish and versatile, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. Rothy's come in a wide range of colors and patterns, and they're available in four different silhouettes. Plus, they're constantly launching new styles, so you're guaranteed to find a pair, or three, you love. Since Rothy's are seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles, they're ultra comfortable as soon as you slip them on. That's right, there's zero break-in period in these shoes. It will blow your mind that these shoes are made from recycled plastic water bottles. In fact, Rothy's has diverted over 25 million water bottles from landfills. These are feel-good flats in more ways than one. You'll quickly discover why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes. Right now, Rothy's has an amazing deal for Nightcall listeners. Use code NIGHTCALL to get free shipping with no minimum, free shipping and free returns exchanges on your Rothy's shoes. And trust me, you won't return them. Go to Rothy's.com, R-O-T-H-Y-S.com, and enter NIGHTCALL to get your new favorite flats and free shipping. Once you try shoes that are comfortable, stylish, and sustainable, you're never going to wear anything else. Head to Rothy's.com and claim this offer with code NIGHTCALL.
Well, speaking of spectacular performances, we have been talking about Siegfried and Roy because Siegfried and Roy's animal handler, Chris Lawrence, recently gave an interview to The Hollywood Reporter about what really happened with Manticore. Yikes. Emily, you said this was one of your biggest fears.
Yeah. So a, I was sort of surprised to go back and realize that this happened in 2003. This was like horrifying, you know, in front of a live audience. Roy Horn was attacked by one of their tigers during a show, which effectively just shut down the Siegfried and Roy show. Like, they had been, you know, the biggest show in Vegas for most of the 90s. And I swore that this happened when I was younger because I just remember this giving me nightmares. Like, just, you know, you're hearing the news, hearing it on the news on television. Like, it's it's one of the most horrifying things I can imagine, being somebody in the audience watching it happen.
Oh, yeah.
Seems well, like the also, scariest thing.
There's like a whole lead up that I'd kind of forgotten about where they realize that Manticore the tiger is not like doing what he's supposed to do.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of like, Manticore, are you okay? Like, say hello, Manticore.
Yeah.
And so it's like that awful feeling of being in the audience when something's going wrong
and you don't know,
nothing bad happens, but this is like the worst thing happened.
Yeah. Can you imagine if you saw that?
No, oh that's God. What I'm saying. It would scar you forever. And apparently it did scar this guy, Chris Lawrence, the trainer, the main handler. And so he hadn't talked to the media for some time, but he's like, you know, he's been diagnosed with PTSD, understandably. I mean, he was right there on stage as it was happening. And he, like, feels like he bears this responsibility for how it played out because he had, like, agreed to have this tiger be used for the show even though they had planned on another one. Like, it was just, like, all the stuff that obviously, you know, nobody could have predicted, but he's been blaming himself for ever since.
And also, so there's the investigation that happened afterwards. It seems shady as hell. Like, they would not take Chris Lawrence's statement. So he said he felt as though he had to kind of clear his conscience. But it's like the brand, the like Siegfried and Roy brand kind of remains of just like, you can't blame the animals.
Yeah.
It's not the animals' fault. And I guess that there was some people kind of were like, well, maybe Roy was having a stroke and the tiger wanted to.
Yeah, that's
help
the story.
Him.
Yeah, that he was having a stroke on stage, which he did suffer a stroke, but it was after the tiger had punctured his artery.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has suffered a loss of blood from his brain. So he did have a stroke. But yeah, it feels like the whole thing was just to, you know, even if they weren't going to have a show anymore, if they were going to merchandise in it anyway and they, you know, they produce some kid show afterwards about a lion or whatever, like the idea that lions are our friends needed to stay intact. You know, big cats are our friends and they won't hurt us and they've been improperly branded, which, you know, clearly.
Well, Roy was like, I guess Siegfried was more the illusionist and Roy was more like the tiger guy.
Yeah.
He always claimed like he had never, never even faced any aggression from any of the animals and he had like a psychic bond with them. I mean, this was all like, you know, there was cat dancers in, I think, 2007, right? And then, you know, there's the Siegfried and Roy thing coming out. And then Grizzly Man, there's like this trifecta of
Grizzly Man
lessons.
Is also 2007, I think, too.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, but like Werner Herzog voice, like, You cannot tame the cats.
Can't tame nature.
You cannot tame the cats.
Cat dancers in the Siegfried and Roy story have this sort of like sheen of Vegas showmanship on top of it, which is like the show must go on because we're in the cat dancing business.
Well, also, Cat Dancers was like the most interesting love triangle.
Oh my God.
Ever. And that came out, that was like packaged with Crazy Love, I remember, which was the love story, the scare quotes, love story of a couple where the man had blinded the woman by throwing poison in her face.
Oh my God.
And those two came out at the same time. And I remember being.
Was that
like,
on HBO?
Yes. They were both on HBO. And they were, I believe, interviewed together, whereas Cat Dancers, there's the one remaining member of the love triangle.
And it's like this guy, the Chris Lawrence, the trainer for Siegfried and Roy, like he's obviously traumatized and he had worked with these guys for a few years and worked with these animals for a while. But like the added like brutality of Cat Dancers is that the guy, and now I'm blanking on his name, the guy who's the main storyteller in that
Ron Holiday,
like he watched not just like people he had been working with, but like literally the two people he loved most in the world get, you know, torn apart in front of it. Like,
well,
it's so
bad. But it's
bad.
Also such an unreliable narrator type of thing because he was, I think you could probably feel some jealousy going on from Ron. And so when first the tiger attacked the guy who was like the third person, Chuck, that happened. And then Joy was like so bereaved. And I think that that kind of like didn't sit well with Ron. And then you add to that the fact that Joy's death
you
by Tiger.
You guys are giving so many spoilers
for
I'm
Cat sorry.
Dancers.
We got to spoil.
I will just say that like this came up. I had not seen Cat Dancers before last week. Yeah, no, I hadn't seen it because I was talking about the Siegfried and Roy story. And then huge shout out to both Price Peterson and Gideon Yago, who both pointed me towards Cat Dancers, which I had heard of. I think it came out during my dark ages with cable, where I just didn't have any, like, I didn't have HBO or anything like that.
I owned it on DVD for some reason, and I would, like, make a lot of...
For all the right reasons.
I think I made a lot of people watch it.
Yeah.
Maybe including Tess.
Yeah. You definitely told me to watch Cat Dancers, and it took, like, 2 seconds into the pitch. I was like, I will
find
this.
Well, the name is very... doesn't tell you that much. It feels, in a lot of ways, like we're just, like, litigating the 80s, finally, is what I was saying, because there's, like, a Michael Jackson mention in this, and it also... just all the things you're like... Everything is so weird that they're talking about like a magician stage show with tigers on stage that's for children.
Michael Jackson used to just come and hang out with the animals, apparently, according to the Hollywood Reporter article, like to the point where the trainers were like annoyed with him. So he would just stay and linger.
It's also like Siegfried and Roy were lovers and then just work partners, which makes you wonder.
I didn't realize they weren't. I thought that they were still together.
No. I think they broke up. But
no, because Siegfried's still taking care of Roy.
Yeah, he's taking care of
him. But I think they're still like best friends. I think they talked about it. Like they were no longer together romantically, but they were still like life partners.
Look, all I want is the Steven Soderbergh Siegfried and Roy movie, like so badly.
Yes. Yeah, you said that. And then I was like, that is so correct. And then I pitched that it should be Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
Yes.
with Ben Affleck as Roy Horn. I feel like this could really be the role of a lifetime.
Yeah.
I think we should make it happen, you guys. We'll start a Seed and Spark about it.
Yes.
We'll raise that money.
Steven Soderbergh. Come on, night call.
I already told Molly and Emily this, but I do just want to share that I had an encounter with Siegfried and Roy that like haunts me forever, which is that I was going to a cousin's wedding in New York, and this would have been like 3 to 4 years. So it would have been 99 or 2000. And my whole family was staying in this hotel. And I was having a guest in my room and I had lit candles. And in the lobby, there was a giant like pet carrier and there was a tiger inside. And then Siegfried and Roy like walked through the lobby. And I was like, this is the weirdest day ever. And then at the end of the same day, I accidentally lit a lampshade on fire with a votive candle. And it was my most cinematic day. So thank you, Siegfried and Roy.
Did you see the tiger?
I saw the tiger.
What color was it?
It was a white tiger.
What?
And then I fact checked myself before I came here because I was like, am I sure it was this hotel? Like, it seems really weird that they would allow those in the hotel. And one of the people who worked at the hotel gave an interview and was like, one of the weirdest things I ever did working at this hotel was to watch the tigers from Siegfried and Roy's Tigers in the lobby to make sure nobody approached them. Yeah.
Again, you're just like, okay, so they just let the tigers be in the lobby of a hotel in New York? Just...
They were in cages.
Yeah, were they doing a show in New York?
Come on.
I have no idea.
I mean.
I would assume.
That has to be like a publicity thing or something, too. It's like.
They have to get them around. I mean, it's weird to think, like, how do you get on a private plane? I don't know. They're 400 pounds.
Look, let's just get to the point. It's not the tiger's fault, y'all.
It's never the animal's fault.
But it is like maybe you have to be an insane person to be like you have to have a little bit of a death wish to work with big cats like that.
It's a rush. I don't know, though. It's like I think you can just brainwash yourself into thinking that you're somehow a like special person is not.
Well, I do that with my small cat.
Yes. See, so you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone does that with animals. We should go to Tippi Hedren's big cat preserve.
Oh, my God.
I don't think it's now's not the time after talking about this. I'm just like, let them be. Let them be in nature.
Don't you want to face death by like looking it in the eye across the void of species?
No.
No.
And I say this as a person with way too many pets. No. Not really.
Whiskey. Oscar. Mike. Bravo.
This week's episode of Night Call is brought to you by Cheers Health. This is Emily, and I am an old lady, and I have gotten to the point where the amount of drinks that used to just kind of roll off me and I didn't care about anymore are actually kind of impacting my life. It is a problem, I think, for anybody who's past the age of 25. If you drink more than a couple drinks in a night, you're not going to feel 100% the next day.
This is true. I think it was literally like the day I turned 25, I noticed that I was like, okay, I can have one glass of wine with dinner and be fine. But if I wasn't going crazy or anything. Once a year, I do go crazy to do drunk history, but normally I do not because I want to stay alive. But yeah, I noticed I was like, okay, I can have one glass of wine. If I have any more than one glass of wine, I wake up, I have a headache, I just don't feel great. And especially since having kids, because you have to wake up no matter what at like 6. But it also kind of sucks to miss out on celebrating birthdays, New Year's, just being able to like relax with a couple drinks and not feel like garbage the next day is really nice. So Cheers is really helpful for that.
Yeah, we got our samples of Cheers just last week. And I was very curious, so I went out after a day of spending the day inside. I was like, oh, I'm just going to go to my local bar and I'm going to have maybe one more drink than I would usually have just to see how this thing works. So I had 3 glasses of wine and pretended to watch basketball and then came home and took both the oral rehydration system powder and the 3 after alcohol aid tablets, which is what you're supposed to take, and watched Cat Dancers. And woke up the next morning and felt amazing. It really helped me get the rest of my day back in a way that, like, I think normally I would have felt sluggish and not able to work as much the next day. And I kind of just felt more or less on top of things, which was a great help.
I took it and I had 3 glasses of wine and I woke up the next day. And the thing I noticed the most was that I always get a headache and I didn't have one. And Cheers is healthy for your liver, too, so you can feel good about taking it. To use Cheers, you just take 2 to 4 capsules after your last alcohol beverage or before you go to bed. If you don't wake up feeling at least 50% better the next day, you get your money back guaranteed, which is nice. I felt more than 50% better, I will say.
So to order Cheers, Nightcall listeners can go to cheershealth.com and enter promo code Nightcall at checkout to get 10% off of your first order and a free gift. That's cheershealth.com, promo code Nightcall, NIGHTCALL, for 10% off and a free gift with your first order.
Always remember to cheers.
With Cheers, you're going to start feeling better when you wake up, and your liver is going to thank you.
Speaking of brushes with death that awaken the fire within, we are going to talk about another movie for The Erotic Odyssey.
We watched this week Adrienne Lyne's 9.5 Weeks, as promised. Is it Lynn or Lyne? I think it's Lyne.
I think it's Lynn.
I don't know, and I'm glad someone else said it.
Yeah.
Here's what I have to say about 9.5 Weeks. That was an air horn. Nice. That was the best movie we've watched.
It's so good.
Yeah. I mean, Fatal Attraction I'll always be really loyal to, but this came very close to toppling it. I had low, low, low expectations. I'd never seen
this
movie.
You've never seen it?
No, I don't know why.
No.
Oh, I went through a period when I had a lot of time when I watched all the erotic thrillers. It was right when you could first watch movies on the internet
legally.
Oh,
yeah.
And I was just like, ooh, I'm going to watch every movie I ever wanted to
rent. Did you watch the uncut version or
That's what I was about to ask you guys.
Yeah. I have no idea. So I watched whatever was on the internet.
It's on iTunes. It's $15. I was like, it was a horrible moment. I sat there for like 5 minutes being like, I don't know, $14.
But you did it.
No, I didn't. I didn't end up doing it.
Like, I might buy it. Just to see
Emily, I'm right behind you.
Well,
I'm going to do it too.
I'm
going to
watch this movie again. It is so good. Like, I feel foolish for not having seen it now, but I also feel like maybe I needed to wait till this moment in my life to see it. Mm-hmm. It contains volumes. I think it's like a fascinating film, and I could probably talk about it for 2 hours on this podcast.
No, me too. We have to get through everything. Like, we've already had text chains and everything about this, but let's uninitiated,
sum it up. Yeah,
this movie came out in 1986. It stars Kim Basinger as Elizabeth, Mickey Rourke, which, by the way, I've never in my life been like Mickey Rourke.
Hey,
I'm gonna say Mickey Rourke.
You've never seen a Mickey Rourke movie from a while
no,
ago.
No, I have to say, I was like,
have you seen Diner?
Yeah, I was gonna say Diner.
I was not even drawn
Diner.
In. He's hot in Diner, but there's something special going on with Mickey Rourke. Margaret Whitten plays Molly. Tony Soprano's lawyer is in this movie ordering a hot water with lemon and sweet and low in like one of an early scene that I was like, I like this movie. It's a very weird movie. Christine Baranski has like one line and she puts a spoon on her nose and everyone laughs and that's it. And it also stars Karen Young, who I did not know who this woman was, but I knew she was in something else I loved. And she was the FBI agent in The Sopranos, who plays a pivotal role.
That's such an amazing call, because I did not see that. And as soon as you said that on the text chain, I was like, oh my God.
It was
going to
make me insane. I was like, who is she?
Emily introduced an idea, which is the bingo, the erotic thriller bingo.
Yeah, based on our observations thus far, we have a long list. I can go through the ones I have written down, because I started to write them down while I was watching this, as they occurred to me. But, okay, so we have Houseboat, which this movie has a houseboat.
Check.
It's not his only residence. In fact, it's like a friend's house, but it's the first place that he takes her to. So it's like seduction via houseboat, which very much fits into the genre. Venetian blinds, of course. Future stars of The Sopranos. Cocaine. An art gallery. Separately, an art collector. Opera music. Sex tapes, sex on stairs or elevators, the Pacific Northwest, and exhibitionism.
Spaghetti and dinners with red wine.
Spaghetti dinner, yes.
Garter belts, which I swear to God, I was like, no one wore garter belts except in these movies in the 80s. Like, everyone
there
wore legs.
There were a lot of garter belts in music videos also in the
80s. Yeah.
Everyone just was just wearing legs with two G's that came in the egg.
Everybody was like a leg person in the 80s.
Yeah. Leg, I'm a leg man.
I only, the 80s, that's legs.
No, I'm thinking about all those. There's like so many videos that involve just like high heels and like socks, you know, that was such a big thing in the 80s that I'm still like the height of sexiness.
Oh, yeah.
High heels with frilly socks.
I also just learned
sex
what gleeking is. Gleeking?
You just learned what gleeking is?
No, I didn't know what gleeking was. And during the spaghetti dinner, I was like, did he just gleek at her? Like, this is,
Wait,
the whole
that?
Movie was so funny.
It's when you squirt saliva through your teeth.
It's something only some people can do, but they can gleek.
Roy, our producer, is saying he can gleek.
You can gleek, Roy?
I didn't know it was a thing.
No, this is. I just learned last week about gleeking, and I was like, what? And then I was like, I just caught an accidental gleek with that spaghetti.
They have sex on stairs in this movie. When they are
underground. In the sewer.
Like, basically in a sewer. Well, before we saw it, it was again like like Hand the Rocks at Cradle, where I was like, is this a erotic thriller? Because I knew that it was like a drama, and it's essentially like I was thinking of it as like the prototypical Fifty Shades of Grey. Like, it's just the story of a love affair. I didn't know how much
nobody
of the thriller
dies.
Aspect would be in it. But it is extremely tense to watch. And extreme.
Yes.
Like, I was nervous while watching a lot of this because it is
they
very
use
much...
horror music.
Yes.
I mean, the horror music will come on, like, during a sex scene.
Yes.
And you're like, holy
yeah.
shit. And he also, on the houseboat, he's like, no one can hear you scream. And he
right.
talks at this low register.
And he's always smiling.
Yeah. Always smirking. You know, one of the, like, early scenes where I was like, everyone's going to die. He puts her on a Ferris wheel by herself. He has the guy, like, crank her to the top of the Ferris wheel and then is like, ha, 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 I'm leaving. Goodbye. And
yeah.
I was like, I can't believe she's going to stay. Like, how is there more movie unless he, like, puts her in a basement?
She's yeah. into it.
She's into it.
That reminds me of, like, The Bachelor or anything where they, like, have to jump off of a cliff together and, like, the girl is, like, always genuinely terrified and screaming, and sometimes the guy, too. And then, like, but that's what, like, that's, like, a psychologically proven thing that will draw people together because it's like, oh, my God, we went through this intense thing together, or, like, I went through this intense thing with you. And now I feel like that much more of a bond, even if it's not necessarily a positive bond.
It introduces the S&M that will come into play later.
So, like, this movie is basically just, like, John Gray. Is that his name?
Yes.
John Gray. I mean, it's, like, meant to be the most anonymous name and, like, definitely a precursor to Christian Gray as well. But, like, he's just this, like, a Wall Street guy who meets Elizabeth, who works at an art gallery when they're in Chinatown. And then instant spark, he had to have her type things. They go out. What do they do? They go for a drink at, like, a Polish restaurant or something.
It starts as a normal relationship.
Yeah, it's very cute. It's, like, a very cute seduction.
And then it gets weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, like... It gets really weird.
Well, the other thing that this movie has in its favor is just that it's, like, so gorgeous. It's one of the, like, prettiest New York movies I've ever seen on top of all the bizarre sex that's happening. Like,
yeah, all these movies make me realize why just, like, everyone lived in 80s New York.
Yep.
Yeah. And
had to.
It's a wonderful touch also that all the intertitle fonts are Woody Allen font, but in, like,
it's
sexy
so funny.
Red.
Sexy red. Also, shout out to using Roxy music really well mm-hmm. in this movie. I was like, ooh, it is 80s New York. It's like...
Here's what I learned about this movie, too. It was a bomb
in
America, and then it became a big hit internationally.
In the uncut version.
Unedited.
In the uncut version. Because the Europeans love... Le softcore.
So, like, the arc of this movie is basically, like, he starts introducing this weird sort of dominant and also kind of unconventional. His tastes are unconventional.
His tastes are unconventional.
like, element into the relationship. She's, continually in sort of, like, a I don't know place, and then goes along with it, and it keeps going, like, further and further. She gets, like, more and more spacey at her job. She thinks she's being hypnotized by the watch he gives her. And then it kind of hits this point. I feel like the breaking point is the, like, crawl on your knees for
yes.
the money point, which is, like, so alarming even after all this other stuff. Because some of the stuff I genuinely think is sort of amazing, like sending her men's clothing to dress up in.
And a mustache.
It's so.
It was great.
It's great. And then that culminates in, like, the best sex scene of the entire movie as well, I think, which is the underground sewer sex. because she's like, I just want to be one of the guys. And then he, like, takes her out for a drink and, like, talks about her as if he's, like, another guy, like, locker room talk or something. And then they go and, like, get in a fight, in a street fight.
Okay, but wait, you're forgetting.
They get gay-bashed. People think they're
gay bashed,
a
and then
gay
she,
is that what
and
was
then
happening?
She, yes, and then she stabs the people that
in
are
the
gay
ass.
In the butt.
In the
yeah.
ass. Yeah.
She stabs him in the
butt. And then
they like
sex to celebrate.
It's so weird. It is so weird.
It's amazing.
That I mean, it is.
It's,
you're,
kind
it's
of,
a very confusing reaction
it's
that
It's the Phantom
one has.
Of the Opera.
Kind of. I mean, he is very much like, I don't want to meet your friends. Like,
yeah,
I just
like,
want
I live in a sewer. You can only
your
have
nights
sex with
belong
me in the sewer.
Me.
Like, your night, it's the Phantom of the Opera.
But he's also Patrick Bateman. And Emily
yes.
and I both had this thought. And there's this part where he, like, when he first brings her, I think it's when he first brings her to his apartment, but it may actually be on the houseboat. And he goes, do you like music? And then he's like, Billie Holiday, and he puts on Strange Fruit, and it's like, What a weird. Excuse me?
That is the weirdest.
And I was just picturing Bret Easton Ellis like watching this movie and being like, the logical conclusion is that he's like a psychopath who murders everyone.
I think Bret Easton Ellis is probably watching it and being like, this is the coolest guy ever.
That too. Well, and then he takes her back to his apartment where he has like the six TVs, which is totally like I associate with like less than zero. Like,
well,
the
what's
party
funny? Well, American Psycho, the movie is so good because it parodies all of the stuff that's in all of these movies.
It has
so
the remove
well.
Of being made in the late 90s. So you have that kind of 15 year, at least from the peak of like Wall Street extreme. Yeah.
Made by a woman.
And it's made by a woman in the 90s.
But yeah, this is definitely all the stuff that I thought was like grown and sexy when you first, because that's like when we were kids in the 80s, you were like, this is what grown-ups are like. They wear suits and have Venetian blinds. Yeah. They go to art galleries and eat caviar and then have sex in a sewer after an elaborate fantasy role play.
Okay, well, speaking of the sex scenes, can we talk about the fridge?
Yeah.
The fridge scene?
That's like an upsetting scene for me.
But it was so funny and like over the, and it was parodied like everywhere. Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen like three different parodies of this, but you don't need to parody it because it's its own parody. And the funniest thing is that he like cracks an egg and then slices with an egg slicer, a hard boiled egg, as if he's just like hard boiled it with his mind. And then he gives her like 70 different kinds of cherries. He's like, here's a real cherry. Here's maraschino cherries. Here's some cherry liqueur. He's like, and meanwhile, you're looking into her fridge and all you see is like half a watermelon and the thing is open for so long. And
it's open
pouring,
the entire time. This is the
upsetting
thing. It
drove me insane.
Yes.
Exactly.
You were like, the electricity bill.
Also, they don't kiss for a really long time. He's just feeding her. He feeds her. He starts off with the maraschino cherry. Then I think he goes to strawberries and cherry tomatoes. And then he gives her a jalapeno. And then he kisses her, and it's like her breath has
then
to be so weird.
Milk. No, she gives her the pepper, and then he dumps milk into her mouth, and then he like. But they, I don't think they kiss until after he's like squirted honey all over her.
Yeah.
And the only thing I could think of is like right before this scene, you see the cat come in because she has a cat,
and then like, the cat's gonna get covered in honey and cherry tomatoes.
I'm like, she's on the floor, which is probably disgusting, and she's covered in honey, and he's like licking it off of her.
She's not
like,
thinking about it.
I do love the shot where the cat like just walks out, like sees himself out. He's like, I'm not sticking around for this.
Do cats go in the bingo? I feel like there's some cats.
Oh,
there's
been some good cats.
There's only a bunny and a dog, I believe, in Fatal Attraction, so we can't check that. But there has to be the domesticated animal because these are all domesticating a human kind of thing.
Well, I was very interested to read about the book that this is based off of also. There's a really interesting article about Ingeborg Day, who is the author of the book. She published it pseudonymously. It's called 9 1/2 Weeks, and she published it under the name of the character Elizabeth something, but now her name is out there. But there's a 2012 New Yorker article by Sarah Weinman about she also wrote a memoir under her own name about the fact that she had grown up with it. Her dad was a Nazi, and she's just been trying to reckon with this her entire life.
Bing bong.
Yep. Yeah. And then she also had this, you know, this memoir of this, you know, sadomasochistic affair that like seems to have really upset her and like permanently altered her life.
Well, because it was so much worse than what happened in the adaptation, because if this had been adapted truthfully, you would have been like noping out of there.
That's the interesting thing about it to me, though, is like all the stuff about Mickey Rourke's version of this guy being this sort of domesticated man. Like, he's like, I want to take care of you. I want to cook for you and feed you and like lay out your clothes in the morning, like a housewife, basically.
Yeah.
But then I want to like dominate you at night.
I won't meet your friends.
Right.
Yeah. It's very like Pretty Woman also. It's like we can do all this weird shit, but we can't kiss on the mouth because that's too intimate.
Right. It's so much more interesting than just being a straight up like fantasy, like erotica type thing, because it's such a mind fuck to have this guy who is like both acting out, like I was saying to Tess, I was just like, it's like he read that porn for women book or something. And he was like, oh, yes, I shall be this for her. But is like super, super disturbed. I don't mean to say that like BDSM relationships are disturbed in some way, but clearly this guy has some issues. Like,
well,
and there's a lot of stuff that's like on the border, like, of consensual in this. Like,
yeah,
that's sort of why the whole thing feels so tense, because you're just like, is she into it or is she not? I need to know whether she's into this or not right now.
And her performance is great, because yeah, there are times when you are very surprised, especially at the end, I think,
Kim
by her.
Rules.
Yeah, she rules.
She's so good in this. Yeah.
Also, though, what's interesting about the memoir, 9.5 Weeks, is that right, Ingeborg Day worked at Miss Magazine.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And then she left because this affair drove her to have a nervous breakdown. And actually, the guy she was having the affair with dropped her off at a mental asylum,
yeah,
and then was like, peace out, I'm gone.
Yeah.
Oh,
and she
God.
Was there for months and months. But what's really interesting about this movie and all of the movies on our erotic odyssey, I think, is that part of the real tension is that, you know, Elizabeth seems to like love her job so much,
yeah,
and her affair with John makes it impossible for her to be able to be on task at work, to
yes,
the point
yeah,
where like, as a weird like C plot, she ends up like finding an artist who is maybe suffering from dementia, and because she's like,
it's also yeah, it's also
so,
Velvet
so
Buzzsaw.
Weird, yeah, yeah. Where she's just like, come to this gallery opening, and everyone's like, he's so weird, and then she feels like she's kind of like dropped the ball and like really harmed someone, and that kind of contributes. But it's interesting because all of the erotic thrillers that we've watched from the 80s and early 90s kind of deal with like
art,
a woman feeling, well, it's just like a woman who's like chasing her career,
mm-hmm,
or like balancing the like her like sex life or her family life with her career. And like,
what if this
was
just an
do
allegory about, oh, man, he's just like money corrupting,
well,
her?
Well, that's,
no, that's
he
what
wants
was,
her to be. Yeah, exactly.
That's what
it's
I was
like
saying,
capitalism.
Like, so the scene that like takes place after they hit like, they go like, they have this huge fight because he like brings a third without her consent to the like to the Chelsea Hotel. He like has a sex worker who comes and meets them there, and she wasn't okay with it. And then like they run into they basically have this traumatic like fight slash like they make out at the sex show in Times Square. It's just like horrifying, and like her performance in it is like totally, like, it's, I don't know, she's so good in it. But then she has to go from that to this opening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like when she's in this completely emotionally, you know, wrought place, and then she sees, you know, this artist who's just sort of lost at this gallery full of these like yuppies and like New York art people and stuff. And he's just like this kind of older man who apparently like lives upstate or lives in the country or something. And they both kind of meet eyes, and like that really, I thought that like I started crying, like I like teared up during that,
yeah,
because like
it's a good
for
movie.
Me it was like, it wasn't just that she had like neglected her job, it was like as much as she had kind of like co-opted this guy to be a part of like this New York art scene or whatever, like her being a part of this New York art scene or being like a creative class person was co-opted by this guy just for his like
right,
fun amusement. It's just like this like turtles all the way down type thing, and like
mm-hmm,
realizing that you're a part of this system. And it feels like this origin story for like the next 20 years of New York development and like all the artists and creative people being pushed out and everything too.
No, totally.
Yeah,
because
totally,
even it's like she has an art gallery where it's like she's part of the problem, but she doesn't even know it probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
What
yeah,
a great movie. Adrian
so
Lynn movies.
Or so
Line,
good. I
whatever
know,
they are. They're all kind of about
Unfaithful
like,
is also a like
well,
tremendously sexy movie.
Yeah. They're all about like sex taking over your life to the point of mania where you like can't
yeah,
accomplish anything else, which is like a good thing for movies to
yeah,
be about.
Yeah. And I feel like he really like, he respects the characters enough and like clearly respects the actors enough to get these incredible performances out of them, so that like when you do have what otherwise would feel like a completely unearned sex scene or just like gratuitous, like you're totally in it by that point. You're like,
yeah,
oh, yeah, they're gonna do it in the clock.
And like things can have and like something that has like the sex scenes only are gonna be good if you're like interested in the characters.
Yeah.
Exactly. The characters are so much more interesting than in Jade or Body of Evidence, for
right,
instance.
That it's like, it's
and they're quirky and whimsical, and there's like some like weird, like I was like, is she basing this off of Annie Hall or is that
right,
just the hat and the coats? But there's a like, I'm carrying all these balloons and
no,
laughing at everything.
And they run into
wild,
the little rascals yeah, in Coney
yes,
Island, like
yeah,
on the boardwalk.
The fart
so
song.
Weird.
I want to go to that New York
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, also what's interesting is, so I didn't realize that Kim Basinger like had a horrible bout of agoraphobia where she didn't leave her house for like months, I guess, because she just like couldn't handle it. But it's also a really good view into living in New York when there's like, it just, it's such a weird snapshot of 80s New York that I kind of remember from like being a kid, of just like, there was like lots of yelling. Nobody was like on their phone. I sound so old.
Well, there's yuppies.
Nobody was on their phone. So they were hitting cabs all the time.
There's yuppies, but you still have the Times Square sex shows.
Right.
Right. But downtown also, like, is still genuinely downtown. Like,
yes. Yeah. But it feels like this like very chaotic, like overly like sensory kind of experience. And then his apartment is so sterile and so quiet so calm. And he brings her there and won't let her leave. And it's almost like he's kind of like shielding and protecting her and like almost depriving her from like any sensory stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it's also spoiler. Just like what you...
Like this side is gonna win. Like,
yeah,
no, just that thing of like, I'm taking care of you, but like maybe you don't realize that it's like you don't want it. It's a bad
idea.
But
she did want it.
Well,
but then
I mean,
she didn't want it.
Not to do a psych eval on Kim Basinger, but then she did marry Alec Baldwin, who seems very controlling.
You think?
I mean, again, like, I feel like all these movies are just, like, they're such good roles for women. That's what... I'm like, oh, look at all these great actresses who got undervalued because they were also, like, good sex symbols. Like, Kim Basinger, Rebecca De Mornay.
It's about, like, somebody's internal sensual and romantic interior.
Right.
Like, it's so much more interesting than just being, like, Pretty Woman, where it's like, yeah, like, I was paid for it, and that's how I got in this crazy situation. It's like, she wanted something. She clearly wanted this, and, like, having a character who wants something and is like interested in a certain kind of like unconventional affair is really interesting. And it's like very dramatically compelling on screen.
But all anyone talks about is the food stuff.
The food, because you have to.
We should rank all of the sex scenes in this. For the first half of it, I was like, are there not going to be that many sex scenes other than like this crazy food scene that's happened? And then
I thought that the ice cube sex scene and the sewer sex scene were really up there for me.
Yeah, the ice cube is the first one. It's pretty good. Yeah.
Mickey Rourke, y'all.
I mean, the only thing that kind of ruins the ice cube one for me is that he's like smiling through the whole thing.
He's smiling through the whole movie, though. That's one of the weird things where you're like, what's up with this guy?
So there's that one. The sewer one is good. There's the one that goes awry at the Chelsea Hotel, which is not so fun.
Let's push that down the list.
Yeah. And then...
Clock Tower.
Clock Tower is really good. The Clock Tower is quite good.
Is that the same one as You Can Leave Your Hat On, or do they just all blend together?
That's a different one. Yeah. That's like her doing
a
striptease for him. That was like too goofy. Yeah.
It was like way too goofy.
Different music could have made this work, I feel like. But yeah, it was a little silly.
You guys don't put You Can Leave Your Hat On for sexy times?
It's just so
and
fast.
No one answered.
I was watching, it's such a fast song.
Again, in the 80s, I feel like people were constantly putting on a man's shirt and hat to do a striptease.
Right. And a mustache. Everyone did. The mustache, the fact that he didn't peel off the mustache for so long, I was like, bold choice. Again, this movie full of surprises.
I liked the selection of hotels as well. Like,
because
that was at the Algonquin for the boy date. And then and then Chelsea for the like non-consensual threesome. There were all these different moods and spaces.
Set and setting.
Yeah. And he was like, oh, I used to like live in hotels all my life or something. Like,
right.
Yeah.
You become obsessed with finding out anything about him, because that's the whole thing, is he won't tell her anything about it.
Which is interesting, because like then you watch 50 Shades of Grey and you're like, I don't care what his deal is. Whatever his deal is, I don't care. I mean, it's so like sanitized compared to this movie. They didn't have sex in any sewers, as far as I know, in 50 Shades of Grey or any of that franchise.
Well, and the whole premise of 50 Shades of Grey, and not to knock it, because it has a place in our culture, and I don't deny its importance on some level.
Oh, yeah, I saw them all.
Yeah, but, like, the premise of it is, what if a rich hot guy was into you? And, like, wanted to fuck you expensively. Like, wanted to spend a lot of money on things.
But that first movie... That first 50 Shades of Grey movie is good, because it does also go with the downer ending, where it's like she's getting her agency taken away from herself and she's like, actually, I'm out.
Yeah.
Actually, I can't do this.
Yeah. I guess, well, all findom stuff is sort of like the other way around now, like, right? Like men who want to be dominated by women, right? Do you know what I'm talking about?
You're talking about how
financial
we're going to help.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to be findommed by Night Calls.
I don't think we have the resources to findom anybody.
No, we sure do.
We would like to be dommed.
No, we just, that's, people just send you money.
But like right. The idea, you know.
Heterosexuality is all about being findommed.
It's a transaction.
So, to like draw attention to the fact that there's like a transactional nature between
right.
sex and
that's
money.
Like there on sort of a under the surface level at first. And then I think it really becomes explicit once he starts like the bed scene when they buy the bed. I laughed out loud when they'd like buy a bed. I was kind of confused as to what was even going on, but there's a whole very long conversation with him and this bed saleswoman where they're like customizing the mattress and like picking out the ticking for the mattress. What is ticking? And then he's like, can my lady friend lie on the bed? And it's another absurd scene. I think it's absurd.
And it's a long scene.
It's really long. But there's that whole, it's part of this whole sequence where he's buying stuff for her. Like he buys her like yuppie clothes and he buys her like a riding crop and stuff and like all this stuff. And that is like more centralized in something like 50 Shades of Grey where it's like, cool, we're going to go sex shopping. This is like after they're kind of really in the throes of the relationship. But that definitely exists there. And then, like, obviously, once the money starts to become more and more explicitly a part of the relationship, and from the point where he's making her crawl across the room for it, then that feels like everybody gets a little bummed out.
He also makes her steal, which is, like, I guess that's has its place. But I was like, don't steal.
That's
Molly's
apparently
she knows I have a hang up about
no,
stealing.
No, I don't. I agree. But I think I saw that in the book. That's like,
that's a big part of it. That
in
was actually
real life that he like it escalated into like now we're going to
stealing
like,
and
rob.
Mugging someone. Yeah. And like,
it escalated into crime, which is what it kind of feels like it might in this movie.
Right. Yeah.
But it is interesting because it is like, hey, you know, when you're first dating somebody for the first 10 weeks and they might be a serial killer.
Right,
Right.
Like,
sure.
Actually.
They're either just doing nice things for you or it's because like it's a lead up to they're going to kill you.
Yes.
And this movie really captures that. And that's exciting. What an exciting time.
If you have thoughts on 9.5 weeks or on anything else, give us a call at 240-46-NIGHT. You can also drop us an email at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com. And you can follow us on social media, Night Call Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, Night Call Pod on Twitter. We're going to continue our erotic odyssey until we run out of erotic thrillers.
Yeah, if you have any suggestions.
Yes, we've been enjoying getting the suggestions. That's where some of these have come from. So please keep sending them.
I heard another request for Jagged Edge.
Okay, we'll do Jagged Edge.
From friend of the pod, Karina Longworth. So, Karina, we will do Jagged Edge for you.
Perfect. Let's do it.
Come on, Karina.
Yes, Karina has to come on the pod.
See y'all next week. That's it. That's my bye.
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 Bye.